The Mountain. We are Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, two states and two perspectives on climate. The National Resources Defense Council says New York's budget misses the mark on climate and commits ratepayers to billions in new gas infrastructure. We'll speak with the NRDC's Utility Regulatory Director for New York's Climate and Energy Programs. In Pennsylvania, the state doesn't offer incentives or subsidies for renewable energy project. That's why the Clean Energy Co-op steps in to offer those often large upfront capital costs. We'll speak with them. Plus, the Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg in June, and in addition to a new theme, there's a new writing competition. We'll learn more. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The New York Court of Appeals today overturned the 2020 sex crimes conviction of former Hollywood movie producer Harvey Weinstein, saying he didn't get a fair trial. In a 4-3 decision, the court found the trial judge who presided over the case made a crucial mistake by allowing prosecutors to call witnesses who said Weinstein assaulted them, but whose accusations weren't part of the charges against him. It's not clear how this will affect Weinstein, who's currently in prison in northern New York. He was also sentenced to 16 years in prison in California for rape. Nor is it clear whether Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg will retry the case. President Biden and the leaders of 17 other countries with citizens held or missing in Gaza released a joint letter today calling on Hamas to immediately release vulnerable hostages and agree to a deal that would bring an immediate and prolonged ceasefire that would allow for a surge of aid into Gaza. The Supreme Court hears arguments today on a question it has never addressed before, whether a former president is forever free from being prosecuted for what he claims were his official actions while in office. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
President Trump is currently facing four sets of criminal charges, three of them for actions he took as president. In the case before the court, he's facing trial for willfully and falsely seeking to prevent Joe Biden from being declared the duly elected winner of the 2020 election. Scholars on the right and left have largely agreed that Trump does not have such immunity, but many expect the conservative court majority to limit its eventual ruling in both timing and substance, thus making it difficult, if not impossible, for Trump to face trial on these charges prior to the November election. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened lower this morning as the Commerce Department reported a slowdown in economic growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow tumbled more than 600 points in early trading.
GDP grew at an annual rate of 1.6% in the first 3 months of the year. That's slower than forecasters had expected and slower than the 3.4% growth rate in the final months of last year. Consumer spending is holding up relatively well, especially when it comes to services like travel and restaurant meals. Consumer spending on durable goods was down during the quarter, though, possibly reflecting the drag of higher interest rates. Higher mortgage rates have weighed on the housing market, but construction of new homes is up. Residential investment jumped at an annual rate of nearly 14% in the first quarter. Business investment was also up while government spending slowed. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
Wall Street is sharply lower at this hour. The Dow is down 697 points. The Nasdaq is down 322. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Former President Donald Trump is back in a New York courtroom today as his criminal hush money trial continues. The jury will hear more testimony from a veteran tabloid publisher. Trump also faces the question of whether he violated a gag order from the judge in the case. The UK is opening its Northern Ireland archives to independent historians to examine the period of Catholic-Protestant fighting known as the Troubles. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
Any historian can apply, and five will be selected by an advisory panel of academics from universities in Belfast, Dublin, Oxford, and Cambridge. They'll get full access to the UK State Archives. The government wants them to provide a, quote, independent and authoritative examination of its own policy during the decades of Catholic-Protestant fighting in Northern Ireland, which ended with the Good Friday Peace Agreement 26 years ago. The goal is to write a public history of the conflict. In the past, the UK has commissioned historians to do something similar for UK Navy actions during World War II and for the conflict in the Falkland Islands. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
TikTok is threatening to sue over the new U.S. law that says the app's Chinese owners have to sell the company within the year or the app will be banned in the U.S., citing U.S. national security concerns. App owner ByteDance says the law is a violation of its users' First Amendment rights, calling it unconstitutional. Again on Wall Street, sharply lower. The Dow was down 687 points, the Nasdaq down 284. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Before we get started with today's show, a program note. Right now, the Supreme Court of the United States is hearing oral arguments in case 23-939, Trump versus the United States. At stake is whether or not former President Trump should be protected under articles of presidential immunity in the felony charges brought against him for his role in attempting to subvert the 2020 U.S. presidential election. Attorneys for the former president and the special counsel's office will each make arguments and take questions from the justices. You can listen to live special coverage of the Supreme Court hearing right now at our website, wjffradio.org. Now, the New York State Legislature approved a budget over the weekend, nearly 3 weeks after the deadline, but the National Resources Defense Council says the $237 billion plan misses the mark on climate. The NRDC says the budget didn't change two laws that are making it hard to meet its climate goals in 2019. The budget kept the 100-foot rule, which makes current gas customers pay for expanding gas service to new customers. It also didn't change the rule that forces utilities to supply natural gas to new customers. Jason Dole spoke to Christopher Casey, the NRDC's Utility Regulatory Director for New York's Climate and Energy Programs.
We were very disappointed that the final budget didn't take up the what's known as the New York Heat Act, which would remove legal barriers that are obstructing an equitable, orderly, and affordable transition off of the fossil gas utility system. New York's clean energy transition is currently threatened by existing laws governing utility gas service that are perpetuating, promoting, and subsidizing fossil gas use. And the NY Heat Act would have amended the law to eliminate these legal barriers so that the state's regulation of gas utility service supports New York's Climate Act instead of working in conflict with it.
Right. And one of these items in there is this 100-foot rule. Can you explain to me what the 100-foot rule is?
Yeah, the 100-foot rule is, it's known as the 100-foot rule. It's essentially a statute that requires existing utility customers to subsidize the building out of the gas system to new customers. So by law, anyone who is within 100 feet of the existing gas system can have their building hooked up to the gas system for free. And it is free to that customer who is connecting to the gas system, but it's all the existing gas customers who pay for it. And this, almost always results in a big subsidy from the existing gas customers to this new customer. So that's the 100-foot rule that wasn't changed. But there's another really important one that is generally known as the utility obligation to serve or utility obligation to provide gas service. And that essentially creates a legal entitlement to gas service for customers. And what it does is it enables a single customer to block community scale projects that could facilitate a cost saving downsizing of the gas system that would not only be beneficial to from an economic standpoint to every customer served by the gas system, but would also help us achieve our climate and clean energy goals. And that's the provision that was really fundamentally important to addressing, because we know that to meet our climate goals and to do so in a equitable, orderly, and affordable way, we are going to have to slowly pare back the size of the gas system so that it is really right-sized for achieving our climate goals.
And many organizations do this, again, in New York's budgeting process. They weigh in, they ask for certain things, because this is where so much of the state's policy and the year ahead are determined, in the budgeting process. And when something does or doesn't go in, you don't necessarily get an explanation as to why it didn't go in. Nonetheless, I'm going to ask you, do you have any ideas why this wasn't taken up?
I don't, unfortunately. It's from an outside observer, the blame for this really does seem to fall pretty squarely on the Assembly. The Senate has, and really in particular with Assembly leadership, the Senate has passed the full New York Heat Act several times now. And they included it in their budget. The governor did not include the full NY Heat Act in her budget, but she did include the key provisions that are necessary for transitioning the utility gas system. So she was on board as well. But the Assembly didn't include it in their budget, even though there are 76 co-sponsors in the Assembly of the NY Heat Act, which is enough to pass the bill. So amongst rank and file Assembly members, there seemed to be broad enough support behind this bill to move it forward, but the Assembly never really was willing to take it up and have not provided any real explanation for why they did not do so.
So far, we've primarily been talking about regulations, not changing regulations that affect clean heating and the goals of zero emissions in terms of buildings and structures. What about zero emissions in terms of the state's electrical grid and infrastructure of power?
Well, the budget fortunately did make some progress on the electric side. In particular, this portion of the budget known as the RAPID Act, which has to do with creating essentially a one-stop shop for the permitting and siting of new transmission projects. And this is fundamentally important because New York's Climate Act, the comprehensive strategy for addressing climate change, is really dependent on really ambitious targets for decarbonizing the electric sector. And basically decarbonizing the electric sector quickly and then electrifying end uses in other sectors like the building sector, industry, and transportation as a means to reducing emissions. And so this RAPID Act is going to enable us to site transmission upgrades, grid upgrades, site them and permit them more quickly, and it'll help provide clarity for what projects will look like for all New Yorkers, stakeholders, and developers alike.
How are you feeling about the prospects of New York meeting its various clean energy goals? Because, like as I said in the beginning, the clock's ticking on these things.
It's certainly ticking, and the more time that we let go without making meaningful progress towards those goals, the harder, more costly, and less orderly the transition will be. And so it is very important that we take near-term actions to be moving towards achieving our goals. We've made substantial progress in the electric sector, even though we have hit some kind of headwinds because of kind of economic impacts that are lingering from the pandemic and have to do with global political situations that have kind of created persistent inflation and messed up supply chains. But we're making real progress in upgrading our grid and working to identify and pursue the clean energy resources to really transform our electric sector. But we're making less progress on with the gas system transition and in some of the other sectors. But there are real opportunities coming up to put some policies in place that will really help us achieve those goals.
I just want to let the listener know, just a reminder that broadly speaking, there's a lot of details in New York State's Climate Act. But the big headlines here when we talk about these goals, we're talking about 40% greenhouse gas emissions across the entire state economy, 40% by 2030, which is now only 6 years away, and no less than 85% by 2050. And we are talking to Christopher Casey, Utility Regulatory Director for New York Climate and Energy with the NRDC. What you were just saying, there are some opportunities coming up. What are those opportunities?
Well, a big one is that the state is currently working on a cap and invest proposal, which would help both limit emissions and bring emissions down in a kind of an orderly way over time, effectively put a price on carbon and then would raise money, and that money could be used to make investments that could help further decarbonize our economy and do so in a way that is equitable and reaching vulnerable customers and the communities that have are vulnerable New Yorkers and the communities that have been disproportionately impacted by climate change and our energy systems historically. So that's a tremendous opportunity. The state has put out a pre-proposal on what that program could look like. And I think the hope is for a formal proposal later this year, and then establishing a program in 2025.
you know, we're talking about New York State. We're talking about New York State policy and progress towards making policy changes that would positively impact climate change and, you know, emissions. And but when we talk about these things in New York State, you know, New York State, our elected leaders talk about the state leading the rest of the country. And, you know, even the New York legislative policy director for NRDC, Richard Schrader, was saying that New York could have led the nation by changing how utilities provide gas in the recent press release on this issue. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the bigger picture of what the implications are outside of New York when we're talking about these changing New York policies.
Well, certainly New York is at the very forefront of the clean energy transition. We have one of, if not the most ambitious climate and clean energy law in the country. And some of the other states that, you know, arguably also have very ambitious climate laws, like California, are just in very different situations from New York, you know, in terms of the climate, the built environment, some of the challenges. So, you know, the way that New York tackles these challenges and moves forward in its clean energy transition provides a roadmap for others to follow, and it also can prove out ways to accomplish economy-wide decarbonization, and it can do so in a way. It can also lead and show how to do that in an equitable way. And we've already seen some of the positive influence that New York has had. For instance, New York's climate law has provisions that are about ensuring equity while fighting climate change and ensuring that disadvantaged communities are not left behind in the clean energy transition. And the federal government has picked up on those policies and emulated some of them, for example, with its Justice 40 initiative. And so we are, you know, demonstrating you know, how to have a climate and clean energy transition, how to do it in a great way. And I think it's really important to also mention that we're not just leading for leading's sake, that there are very meaningful and tangible benefits for New Yorkers for doing this. It is true that New York is not going to solve climate change on its own, but as we reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we also reduce the toxic local air pollution that occurs when fossil fuels are burned for energy. So there are a tremendous amount of health benefits for New Yorkers, but there are also a ton of economic benefits in terms of investments, in terms of jobs, and kind of, you know, powering our economy in a new way that is more sustainable and less susceptible to being impacted by things like wars in other countries, or that can impact things like you know, the price of gas or oil.
All right. Well, Christopher Casey, Utility Regulatory Director for New York Climate and Energy from the National Resources Defense Council, I want to thank you for going over all this with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, more on climate, this time in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's Clean Energy Co-op. They sustainably develop renewable energy resources using local investment. We'll hear more next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow West Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Created in 2014, the Clean Energy Co-op helps provide the often large upfront capital costs required for renewable energy projects in Northeast Pennsylvania and beyond. Pennsylvania does not offer incentives or subsidies, and other financing is limited, so the Clean Energy Co-op employs a slow money approach by emphasizing community benefits over profits. Jack Barnett is the co-founder and treasurer of the Clean Energy Co-op, and he joins us now. Good morning, Jack.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And thank you for being here. You know, as I was getting started to look at what we were talking about today and reading through, I was surprised to learn that Pennsylvania does not offer incentives or subsidies for renewable projects in the state, and the financing is limited. Can you explain a little bit what's going on there?
Yeah, Pennsylvania is definitely far behind New York, as the previous caller talked about. We're struggling here. It's wrapped around politics, of course. We just haven't had any state incentives since 2013.
Wow.
And in fact, that timing was part of the reason we got founded in 2014.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that founding. The Clean Energy Co-op sprung out of SEEDS, which was an organization we talked to last week. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that happened and why?
Yeah. SEEDS has been around for almost 20 years now. Well, I guess it was 2017. But in 2013, when the incentives in Pennsylvania ended, we looked around and said, what are we going to do next to drive solar in Northeast PA? We were struggling because those incentives had enabled several local contractors to go into the solar business, and two of them were talking about and ultimately did go out of business. And we were worried about how we were going to get more and more obvious solar. We were doing a lot of activities around residential, and we still are. But SEEDS said, let's get a committee together and figure out how we can take on what we called at the time community solar. And we still don't have community solar in Pennsylvania, but we do have a way to finance systems that support community investment.
And why a co-op? Why that setup?
Oh, that was very clear early on. We wanted to be not driven by the money. We wanted to be driven by the community. So we support a model where every member gets one vote, regardless of how much they put into the projects and our financial condition. It's really all about one member, one vote.
And how does a slow money, that approach, work in terms of investing?
Yeah, so the way we work in general is first you join the cooperative, and right now we have about 177 members, mostly individuals, but a few entities as well. And that's $100 to join one time, and then you own a membership share in our cooperative. If you're a Pennsylvania state resident and you're a member, then you can invest in our projects, which only come up maybe once a year. And we are typically doing that through a private offering, and that's very important because that's an exemption from state and federal regulations. We can only do it as a private offering to our members who are Pennsylvania residents. And typically what we're doing there is selling preferred shares in our cooperative. And that is a limited return on those shares. Typically a 2% dividend is what the board has declared yearly.
All right.
So that's the idea of slow.
And how is that different from a membership then? Is that, or is it a membership?
Well, first you have to be a member.
Yeah.
And that's important for our complying with regulatory. And so that's $100. And then that's one share maximum per person. Can't do more than that. But the investment in the projects, when you go to buy the preferred shares, those you can buy more than one, but you don't get any more votes when you buy more than one.
And what are some of the projects that you have made so far, some of those investments so far?
Yeah. Our first project was in 2015 on the cooperage in downtown Honesdale. So that array is a 27-kilowatt array, and it's been powering the cooperage more than 100% of their electric needs ever since. We followed that up with two loans to two local organic farms in Wayne County, the Ant Hill Farm and the Will-O-Wisp Farm. So their solar arrays were financed with loans, the low-interest long-term loans from the co-op. And then more recently, we did a church over in Luzerne County in 2022. We did the Ritz Theater in Hawley in 2023. And in 2020, we did a Wayne County government building, which houses the Storebridge Incubation and Public Work co-working space, the Storebridge Project building in Park Street on Helensville.
And what's up now? I see that on the website, one of the projects, the Weaver's Way Co-op in Ambler, is postponed, but the Weaver's Way in Germantown is underway.
Yeah. So part of our promotion led us to be connected with many other groups around the state and actually outside the state looking to repeat our model, and we were glad to help anybody do that. But this group down in the Ambler, Philadelphia suburbs reached out to us in 2021 and said they wanted to do the same thing. We tried to help them do that, and then they turned around and said, wait, why don't we just join your co-op instead of forming our own? So we actually changed our bylaws to support an idea of chapters. So we now have a chapter in southeast Pennsylvania as well as our home base here in northeast. And that chapter is now bringing their first project to fruition in a partnership with the Weaver's Way grocery store chain. It's a small, also a cooperative, but they have 10,000 members or more. But they've been operating grocery stores in the area of Philadelphia since the 1970s. And their newest store is in the Germantown neighborhood. It's a renovated, almost a food desert when they started, but they're hoping to open the store next month in May, and we want to put solar on that building as soon as possible thereafter. And so we're currently having a membership drive in the southeast area and supporting that project and its financing, hopefully by like next month or June at the latest.
And you're interviewing for folks to be a candidate for a site or a host organization for more community solar. How can folks get involved, and what are the things you're looking for?
Yeah. First off, anybody who's anywhere can join the cooperative. We can't invest in the projects unless you're a Pennsylvania resident, and we have many New York members as well, but they are not eligible to be investors. But we're all excited about finding new candidate projects, particularly in the northeast region of Pennsylvania. We really can't take on New York side projects at this time, maybe someday. But, yeah, we are looking for nonprofits or other community organizations. We've talked to, you know, fire companies, churches, medical facilities, any nonprofit that owns its building. All of those are potential candidates for solar, and we'd love to help them finance the project with no cash up front so that they don't have to pay for it except through monthly purchases of the electricity the solar array produces.
All right, and folks can get more information at cleanenergy.coop. We've been speaking to Jack Barnett, the co-founder and treasurer of the Clean Energy Co-op. Jack, thank you so much for joining us now and telling us about the slow money approach in these investments in renewable energy in Pennsylvania.
Thanks, Tim. Glad to talk about it anytime.
All right. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. SUNY Sullivan's theater program season this year explores the theme of identity, with each play delving deep into the difficult choices characters make as they begin to determine who they fully are. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Jessica Lopez-Barkle and Nick Lopez about the upcoming performances at SUNY Sullivan.
Good morning, Jessica and Nick, and welcome to Radio Chatskill. You are a busy, busy couple, I see. You have two plays going on at the Zelig Theater in Loch Sheldrake at SUNY Sullivan. First one performance is this Friday, the 26th. And they're interesting because one is a very old 16th century Lope de Vega. And then the other is contemporary, which I thought was very interesting and exciting. Jessica, can you tell us about the plays?
Yes. I'll speak about Fuente Bajuna, which is one of the first revolutionary plays, in that when we teach it in theater history or history in general, because it is somewhat famous on different sides, because it was a real thing that happened.
Yes.
And in the town of Fuente Abejuna, which I think it's Fuente Abejuna in Spain now, but there's just pronunciations have changed. But in that actual town in Spain, they had a really horrible commander from the Order of the Calatrava. And he was raping the women. He was doing all sorts of things you're not supposed to do, burning things, just a horrible, horrible man. So they killed him.
Okay.
Yeah. No spoilers. And the amazing story about this is that when the Reyes Catalicos, Ferdinand and Isabel, found out about this, they sent the inquisitors, because that's what they did. And the inquisitors were torturing every member of the town, and every member of the town told them, when they asked who did it, they said Fuente Abejuna. They blamed the town.
Whoa.
And so it's this beautiful play that also highlights the power of women, because it was the women who really came to the men of the town and they said, you are sheep. You know, you need to fix this. And they fixed it in a way. But to Ferdinand and Isabel's credit, they didn't, they could have just, you know, decimated the town, but they said, well, since the whole town is throwing the whole town under the bus, then there's not much we can do.
Wow, that's quite a story.
Yeah. For us, we've been doing every other year a Golden Age of Spain play because of our Latinx community here in Sullivan County. And we have also always provided it in the original Spanish. And we've added some of the Spanish to the production this time. And
good.
We're singing most or all of the songs in Spanish.
All the songs.
I think we're singing all the songs in Spanish.
All the songs.
And so every year we've been doing one because there isn't a lot of performance-based research in this. And so there's a couple of places in the United States that do it. We're one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is up at UMass Amherst, and another one is over at UCLA. And so we're kind of special that we have this tradition of doing it consistently. Some people do one-offs, and we've just decided that that's a thing that's in our community, and it's a thing that's a part of our home life and our beliefs that there are other Shakespeares in our canon of literature. You know, there's Kalidasa, which we're also doing as a kid's play right now as well. And it's, you know, that's the Shakespeare of India. And there's, you know, Molière, the Shakespeare of France. So there's no reason to only just offer Shakespeare all the time. And we do Shakespeare, but we think that the Golden Age of Spain plays, especially because they also have a lot of sword fighting, which is a lot of fun for students to learn and do.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so if you want to see sword fighting, that will be happening in the show.
How many characters are in the show?
I get a little ambitious there, hoping that we can get more community members involved and more students involved, but we also decided to do two shows at once, which kind of cut down on our casting pool. So there will be puppets.
Also.
Because if you run out of characters, you can always add a puppets.
Okay.
Which they teach you in directing school. They're like, well, if you don't have enough actors, get a puppet. And I'm like, oh, we have those. So yeah, it's a whole town. The play is a whole town and a whole town that fights for their town. And so our town is living somewhere in Jim Henson.
Okay.
You know, there's people there. There's a little bit of Sesame Street with real people. You know, it's going to be fun. Oh. I think for people who come, it's going to be outdoors in our labyrinth that we're setting up.
Oh, okay.
Unless the weather is not really holding out, then we'll move it to our lobby. But it's a beautiful space that we have right next to parking lot one in SUNY Sullivan. And it looks like an old Greek theater right now. It's so beautiful to perform out there. So we're excited to show it off.
Oh, let's keep our fingers crossed for the weather. Yeah. That sounds wonderful.
If it doesn't snow.
Yeah.
Okay. And Jessica, I noted you adapted and directed this particular piece.
Yes.
Okay.
I've been working with his mother, actually, Blanca Lopez in New Mexico, whose first language
Hi,
is
Mom.
Spanish.
Okay.
So we've been, she's worked on the past couple with us and just kind of helped us as somebody who grew up reading this stuff. And for her, it's normal. He is the Shakespeare of the Spanish language. So, and she's like, this is one of my favorites. And one of the first we did was Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz's Desire. House of Desires, and she got so excited. She was like, that's the only poem I have memorized is from Sor Juana. I was like, I'm the best daughter-in-law ever.
Nick, now you are directing the play Fairway. Fairview.
Yes.
Excuse me, Fairview. The Fairway.
There is a Fairway in that Fairview.
Yes, by Jackie Siblis Drury. Pulitzer Prize-winning play, very, very current, actually. I believe 2015.
2019.
That's current.
So it's very new. Mm-hmm. It's very new, especially.
And she's young, right?
Yes.
Ish. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This is an amazing piece that really kind of rocked our world when we first read it and started teaching it in our classrooms. This is a play I teach all the time. I teach it both in my theater classes and my intercultural communications classes. A lot of it is based on this idea of perspective. And how sometimes that can be misconstrued due to not understanding other cultures or other people's perspectives. It is indeed – I always like to say that it is difficult when it comes to walking a mile in someone else's shoes or seeing someone else's perspective. That one thing we forget is that that's work. That's hard work. And the play kind of shows what happens when we don't take the time or the pains to really see other people, where other people are coming from, or what they need from us. And this is a sort of a lot of dialogue that's going on in our country today when it comes to sort of race relations, conflicts that we see, the sort of an inability to connect and understand where certain people are coming from. And the way Drury has written it is done in a way that's very satirical and very comedic. It's a very funny piece, you know, and it's a very heartwarming piece at times too. You know, and it goes all over the place when it comes to its tone, its tonality, and its message. You know, and in the end, like any good play, it never fixes anything, it never answers anything. Just like Ibsen's Dollhouse or any other great moving play, all it leaves us with are questions, and that will then hopefully initiate discussions to help us better connect with each other in the future. But the play itself is just fantastic. I love the architecture of it. You know, there are very few plays out there that I can really see. Like the structure of it is very crucial in the way that it's done. And so you really have to pay attention to how everyone interacts and how they affect each other, or how they inadvertently, you know, give off the wrong message. You know, it's a really great piece. You know, it's funny. I get a lot of joy out of it. Our actors are great.
How many?
I think anywhere to like see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Eight actors total.
Wow.
Yeah. Eight actors total, you know. So it's not the biggest piece, but they do – it's very much an ensemble piece.
Yeah.
Very much. Sometimes it's very divided and separate, but then it comes together at the end to make this sort of really – this cacophony of chaos and miscommunication, which then ends with us just talking directly to the. I don't want to give away too much, but
yeah, well, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah,
no.
You
know
what I mean.
Yeah,
but this one you have to see in order to
even reading it can be a bit daunting.
Yeah,
you know, it's very. It took me a few reads to be like, oh, I see. So this is definitely a piece that you have to see on its feet to really understand.
Yeah, my elevator pitch for it has always been, it's like watching Family Matters in the 90s. For the first act. And the second act, you're watching people watch Family Matters.
Or The Cosby Show.
Or The Cosby Show, and they're commenting on it while they're watching it. And and in the third act, those people commenting on it think they can be in it.
Oh, wow.
They think they understand by watching popular media or anything that is pop culture. Like, that is enough.
Interesting. Yeah.
One thing, too, is like there are no – and I say this to the actors, like there are no real bad guys. You know, there's just sort of a lack of information or an inability to connect or communicate that puts us in these situations, you know.
Yeah, you're not placing blame.
Exactly.
You know, maybe responsibility, but not blame.
You know, and I objectively, too, I admire the way Drury really sort of presents the way that communication happens. She's very specific when it comes to specific dialogue and arguments.
And it was wild, too, because during the pandemic – and when a lot of the riots were happening and a lot of the marches, we reached out to our students, you know, all of us stuck in our houses, reached out to our students and had sort of a BIPOC playwright reading series. And we read this one. And I remember this one being the one that was at the end just kind of broke our students, you know, done when we were reading it. Just I specifically remember our student who's a local here, Gem Helper. And she just looked at me like, oh my gosh, this is the first play where I feel like somebody sees what it is to be me as a Black woman and a young Black woman. And so for us, you know, our traditional student at SUNY Sullivan, they walk different walks that, you know, and we don't always give them, you know, to use the title, the fairest view or the realest view of who they are and who they aren't. You know, there might be some stereotypes that we might apply to them, but until you actually get to know them, you're not giving them that view.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us the dates of these performances?
Of course. Fuente Obihuna, The Sheepwell, will be performed outdoors at the Labyrinth on April 27th, May 1st and 3rd at 6 p.m. and May 5th at 2 p.m. Fairview will perform in the Selig Theater April 26th, May 2nd, 4th at 8 p.m. and April 28th at 2 p.m. And so every other day we will be having one or the other. We're either inside or we're outside.
And more information is online, I assume?
It is. You can always visit us at any of the social media places that you might find SUNY Sullivan Theater Program, and also at sunysullivan.edu.
Well, thank you so much. And you've got a lot of excitement this week and next week.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing we could just populate is that we have a theater project that our theater majors did from Kalidasa's Six Seasons. It's a poem about the different six seasons in India, and we're actually performing that at Chris Food Mart Livingston Manor at 11 a.m. On May 4th. So
that's awesome.
It's going to be wild. And it's right on Main Street, and our student Isha Patel's parents run that gas station, and they weren't going to be able to ever see her perform. So they said, hey, can you bring this to the gas station?
Oh,
so
wonderful.
We are. So it's a little 15-minute piece if anybody's up in Livingston Manor on the 4th. We also have Kite Day going on at SUNY Sullivan that same day, but a little tiny piece going to be in a gas station.
Well.
The Shakespeare
Good
of
for
India.
You. Good for you. Well, thanks for all you do for the community and the students, and they are our hope for the future, let's face it.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You. Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
Us.
That's culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to Jessica Lopez-Barkle and Nick Lopez about the SUNY Sullivan Theater Program. We'll take a quick break and we'll get a preview of the Deepwater Literary Festival's first writing competition. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The countdown to the Deepwater Literary Festival in Narrowsburg in June is underway. This year's theme is Another Eden, taking attendees on a deep dive into utopian communities. And the festival is partnered with Black to Nature, an initiative of the Amsterdam News, Catskill Mountain Keeper, and the Black Library for their first writing competition called Reflections on Nature. Joining us with more is Lucy Taylor, co-director of the Deepwater Literary Festival, and Eleanor Tatum, founder of Black to Nature and the editor-in-chief of the Amsterdam News, which is America's oldest continuously published Black newspaper. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Eleanor, we were talking about the writing competition, but I want to talk a little bit first about how did Black to Nature come to be?
Black to Nature came to be during the pandemic, and the Amsterdam News is one of the oldest and largest Black newspapers in the country, in New York City, founded in 1909. And during the pandemic, I was living at my house in Saugerties, New York, and I was hiking and paddleboarding and kayaking a lot, and I noticed that out on the trails and out on the water and in the chat rooms, people of color were few and far between. And when people were on the chat rooms and in the chat rooms and asking questions and trying to access nature, they weren't getting the kindest responses from people. When they were asking very simple questions, when they were trying to find out about how they too could access nature and be a part of the outdoors, when they wanted to just be a part of nature, especially in a time when people really needed that kind of an outlet. And I wanted to figure out a way to try to bridge that gap. And that is basically the way that Black to Nature was born. Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole website with more information, blacktonature.org, about the story and guides and programs. But Lucy, you partner with Black to Nature and Catskill Mountain Keeper and the Black Library for a writing competition at this year's Deepwater Literary Festival. Why did you want to incorporate a writing competition into the festival? And how does this partnership work for you guys?
Well, I've got to be honest, straight up, it wasn't my idea.
Oh.
Ramsey from Catskill Mountain Keeper, I got in contact with Ramsey. This is just all, you know, what happens. This is what I love about the upstate community is that, you know, Sally from Catskill Art Space said, you have to meet Ramsey from Catskill Mountain Keeper. And Ramsey from Catskill Mountain Keeper said, you have to meet Eleanor Tatum and Siobhan Bennett from the Amsterdam News and Black to Nature. And I got on a call with them and I said, you have to meet DJ and Michael from the Black Library. And, you know, that meeting happened and we went away and mused and thought up all the things that we could do. And it was Eleanor and Siobhan that came back to me with this idea for a writing competition. And I just thought it was such a great idea because it meant that we could reach out not just to our community in Sullivan County and our community of color up in Sullivan County, but also nationwide to bring attention to some of the things that we are doing up in this part of the world.
And Eleanor, how does this work into your mission at Black to Nature and then the theme also of the Black the Deepwater Literary Festival?
Well, you know, nature is for everyone. And the whole theme of the utopia and bringing people into nature and the idea of what nature means to people, it just, you know, there was such a synergy when we started speaking to one another. And, you know, the Amsterdam News is about community and about communication. And so it was just a no-brainer, so to speak, to just doing something with writing and being able to have people express their ideas through writing about nature. And so that's why we thought that a writing competition for the Deepwater Festival would be something that would be so perfect. And, you know, I have to have full disclosure, I'm on the board of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. And you know, I've been talking to Ramsey a lot about Black to Nature, and that's one of the reasons why he thought this would also be such a great collaboration. And, you know, Catskill Mountain Keeper is doing so many great things, and that was also one of the impetuses for Black to Nature as well, because there was another connection there to nature.
Let's talk. I wanted to talk about the specifics of the contest. The deadline's coming up May 15th. There's some prize money involved and different categories. Who can enter, and what can you tell us about specifics of the competition?
So there are three categories. There's youth, which is 12 and under. There's young adult, which is 13 to 18. And there's adult, which is 19 plus. And the question is, as a person of color, how do you represent your utopia in writing? And this can be done through poetry, prose, short story, fiction, nonfiction, and we're asking for 500 words or less. And we just want people to write about a special place in nature that they like to go to, or that they wish they had, or dream of a special place in nature, or is there something that they love to do outdoors? And this, you know, and they can write it any way they want, but we want people to just to talk about how they connect. And those are just kind of simple writing prompts that we gave people, so they have a kind of an idea. And it can be fiction, it can be nonfiction. Again, we said it can be poetry. But we just want people to kind of connect to the outdoors through their writing.
And you're not looking for professional writers necessarily. I mean, you could be, but you're looking for just like honest opinions and feelings put to pen to paper.
Exactly. And they can be, you know, never ever writers, or they can be people that have written professionally. But, you know, we just want people that want to be able to just, that have something to say, and that want to put their words out there. And their words will be published in the Amsterdam News, both in print and online, for the winners. And there will be some cash prizes as well.
And again, there's the entry information at blacktonature.org, also information at deepwaterfestival.com. Lucy, we just have a couple minutes left, and you know, we'll have you back to talk more about deep water. But how's the lineup shaping up so far? And you want to talk about your spring auction coming up too?
Yeah, the lineup so far is sublime. I'm really excited about this festival. This is the first time we've done a festival where we haven't used a literary text or an author for the festival. We've actually just come up with an idea. And so we've got an incredible lineup that includes Jamaica Kincaid, Nell Painter, Curtis Zuniga from the Lenape Center. I'm really excited about that. Aaron Robertson, who has a book coming out in October, actually, which won't be available, unfortunately, but we can still talk about it, called Black Utopia. Vivian Gornick and Cynthia Carr. So, and we also have an incredible lineup of local authors we're really excited about, and partnering with you, Tim, at Radio Catskill to make that all possible. And yes, we do have a spring fundraiser coming up in Calicoon on the 17th of May at Catskill Provision. You can go to our Instagram or go to our website, deepwaterfestival.com, to find out more. And we always have a very enviable and competitive, popular silent auction of all the incredible artists and design that gets made in beautiful Sullivan County and the region.
Yep. There's more information at deepwaterfestival.com. We've been speaking to Lucy Taylor, co-director of the Deepwater Literary Festival, and Eleanor Tatum, founder of Black to Nature and editor-in-chief of the Amsterdam News. A reminder again that the writing competition, the first writing competition at the Deepwater Literary Festival, Reflection on Nature, the deadline for that is May 15th. And there are the three different categories, from under 12 to adult. More information at blacktonature.org. Thank you both for joining us, and this sounds exciting.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you so much.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this show, other episodes, and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting. because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Winter hours online at therestorejayville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Join me, Aaron Hicklin, for Shelf Life, a show about books and the people who love them. Each episode, my guest picks two of their favorite books, and then we talk about them. That's Shelf Life, Sunday at noon on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello, streaming live at WJFFradio.org, and you can ask your smart speaker to play WJFF Radio Catskill. Today's forecast, partly cloudy skies, high near 55, clear and cold again tonight, low 29, check the plants. Tomorrow, mainly sunny and a high of 58. A program note that NPR is providing live special coverage of the Supreme Court hearing on Trump versus the United States and the immunity question. You can hear that live streaming audio right now at our website, wjffradio.org. Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. It's 11 o'clock.